Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Digby Jones, former Director General of the Confederation of British Industry, the CBI, and former UK Trade Minister. On this programme, we're talking business. In this episode, there are more than 5 million of them. They employ over 13 million people. They represent 90% of all the businesses in our country. And they provide £1.6 trillion of our income as a country every year. Welcome to the world of small business. Coming up, we travel to the Outer Hebrides to speak to a small business that uses artisan makers in their homes to produce beautiful tweed, which sells round the world. We speak to a furniture maker in the northeast who sends his sofas to Paris and New York. And we'll talk about the really little businesses, the micro businesses, employing just one or two people each, with a company making panniers for bicycles in trendy East London. Welcome to Preparing for Brexit with me, Digby Jones. I'm joined today by James Sibley. He's the head of international affairs at the Federation of Small Business. And when I was at the CBI, I came to understand just what important work they do with this incredibly wide and disparate group in our economy. And they were so helpful to me as we, all of us, carried the flag for British business. The FSB has some 200,000 members, and every single one of them is a mighty business in its own right. James, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Tell me, what's the main challenge that a small business has when they're looking at the 1st of January next year and thinking, oh my God, Brexit's coming?
So, and this might sound the obvious answer, but the main challenge is their size. So, you know, if you compare a small business to a large firm, you're looking quite often at a business that has, you know, fewer human resources, less time to throw at the conundrum that is preparing for the end of transition. And quite often you're looking at a business that has a lower cash flow and lower cash reserves than a large firm. And the other key thing, if you compare a small firm to a large firm, is that depending on the size of the firm, very often you're not talking about a small business that has a legal department or an export department. Maybe if they're lucky, they've got one person doing this. Whereas, they have all that.
You know, they in all different respects, piece of regulation comes in, piece of bureaucracy comes in, and the big business just throws it off to the department and says, get on with that. The woman or the man who get it in a small business, they were the finance director this morning, they're the office cleaner tonight, and they've got to deal with this in the afternoon.
Exactly, that's exactly right. I mean, they're the ones staying up, burning the midnight oil, trying to understand these things.
Do you think they're ready? Or do you think they've got their head in the sand?
I don't think it's a case of head in the sand, but it's definitely a mixed picture. So, from our own research at FSB, we know that about a third of businesses feel that they're prepared for what's coming. And then there's a further third that are they're still in the process of making adjustments, getting ready, but they're not quite there yet. But then there's a further third on top of that who either they don't know if they're ready or they're really concerned that they're not going to be ready come the end of the year. So it's a real mixed bag.
And for those, that last third, which are a lot of businesses, what should they be thinking about? What key areas would you point them to now and say, oi, One, two, three, get on with this.
Well, obviously, it depends on the type of business. And as you know, FSB is a cross-sectoral organisation, both goods, services, everything in between. But the main message that we've been putting out there is that obviously there's, you know, we're talking about a no deal or a deal, but there are things that you can do right now that will be relevant, whatever the scenario come the end of the year. So, you know, if you're in goods exporting, things like registering for an AORI number or contracting the services of a logistics intermediary, this kind of thing. So there are things that you can be doing right now.
Yeah, regardless, actually, that size or proximity of January the 1st is no excuse for that, is it?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, James, I'll obviously be back to you in a little while because we're going to head off now up to the Outer Hebrides. Chilly, just as I say it. It's a place I've been to and it's absolutely wonderful. And it's the home of Harris Tweed. And Pat and I were very lucky to go and look around their museum last summer, the one pre-COVID summer. And, it was so impressive. So here is a small business right on the edge of the UK, right in the northwest of Scotland, and a very special small business it is. I'm joined now by its chairman, and that's Brian Wilson of Harris Tweed. Brian, hello. And how's it in northwest Scotland right now?
Well, where I'm sitting on a clear day, I could see some kilda, but it's certainly not a clear day. So I'm afraid it's a wild and stormy day. In fact, I think you might say it's a good Harris Tweed day.
you're going to sell it on need. You'll sell it on need today, I should think. That's true. There you are, right on the extremity of Europe. And on January the 1st, your big export market's going to change in the way you get in, what you do and how you do it. So tell me firstly, give me a flavour for the sort of way in which you make it right now.
Well, Harris Tweed is a very unique fabric. It's the only fabric in the world governed by its own Act of Parliament, the 1993 Harris Tweed Act at Westminster, which defines not only how it's made, which is from pure virgin wool, but also very precisely where it's made, which is at the home of the weaver, where it's woven at the home of the weaver in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland. And unless it's made in that way and to a very precise procedure, then it cannot be stamped and authenticated by the Harris Tweed Authority. And the stamp, the Orb trademark, is the oldest British trademark in continuous use. So it's got a narrative that others would die for. But the great thing for us is that it's all true.
And is those home weavers, they produce it and then bring it into a central point, do they?
Yeah, the early stages of the process are in our mill at Shawbust and on Isle of Lewis. Goes out the home of the weaver to be woven, and then it comes back to the mill to be finished, stamped and dispatched to the four corners of the earth.
And how many weavers do you have on that basis?
There's about 150 home weavers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I always say it's a kind of classic inverted triangle, because you have, you know, Harris Tweed, the brand, is very well known around the world, but you know, at the bottom of that inverted triangle, you have a very small base of people on whom the whole thing depends.
I remember in Stornoway when Pat and I were there, and you have your museum there and you have the trademark and all of that, but there were so many photographs of these individual home base weavers producing this wonderful product that goes absolutely everywhere around the world. And so that brings us to the 1st of January. They'll keep making it. You'll keep trying to sell it. But how's life going to change for you?
Well, I think the greatest uncertainty is the uncertainty. I mean, if we knew what was happening, it would help. About 20% of our production goes to the continuing EU countries. In volume, it's important, but it's also very important because, you know, we sell to the leading fashion houses of Paris and Milan. That's very important for the cachet of the fabric, but the volumes aren't necessarily very great. But, you know, that it sets the standard and maintains Harris Tweed's place really as the fabric of fashion and the fabric of quality. So the European market is very important. And the most immediate threat, if there is a no deal, is that we would face a tariff of, I think, 7-8%, something like that. And that would have to be absorbed into the costs. You know, because of the process, we're already a little bit more expensive than some other fabrics. You know, you can't go back and say, look, we're adding on almost 10% to the cost because we are being charged that. So hopefully life would go on fairly much as normal if there is a deal and if there is the avoidance of tariffs. But the existence of tariffs would be extremely unwelcome.
And in the middle of that, you're looking therefore at an increase in your overhead, for want of a better word, of about 7.58% to protect. Tariffs are all about protection. So this would be the European Union trying to protect itself against you when no one else on earth makes what you make. I mean, there's a degree of hypocrisy in all of that. But you've got to get it to Milan and you've got to get it through the borders, whether you pay a tariff or whether you don't because of a deal. Presumably, how do you do it? You put it on a truck and get it through the Channel Tunnel, do you?
Well, essentially, we are, because of where we are dependent on a network of hauliers and shippers who take it to its end destinations. The more we can simplify that, the better, and obviously the less bureaucracy there is, the better. We're not a big company, but we've got people who are very expert in the logistics of shipping Harris Tweed all over the world. But the last thing you want is are other layers of form filling. So, I wish Brexit wasn't happening, but I've long since reconciled myself to the fact that it is and all we want now is things to be as near as possible to what they are at present, in which case we can continue to trade normally.
After January the 1st, if we can carry on trading normally, or if we have the tariff but you absorb it, the European market continues to be so important for you.
Yeah, it's very important for both in terms of volume, because about 20% of what we produce goes there, but particularly because of some of the markets that it goes to, which really are the critical to the world of fashion, which we depend on to a significant extent. Normally, in normal circumstances, there are the show around which the whole season depends for the fabric industry generally, that is in Paris in September. You know, so you've got to be able to go there and. Essentially, it works well just now, and let's just hope it works well in the future.
Yeah. And are you having to reorganise anything because of January the 1st, or is it steady as she goes? I mean, are you having to take big reorganisations into account or not?
No, we don't. I mean, if there were things to be done, if there were things, obvious things you could do, then we might do them. But, you know, where we are particularly, and we're only a small industry, then it... We really are dependent on the actions of others, and as I say, if the tariff problem would go away, then hopefully we wouldn't see that much difference.
Well, Brian Wilson, chairman of Harris Tweed, thank you for giving me your time and good luck. It's a fabulous UK brand. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you just keep saying that, and you'll be very very welcome. Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you, Digby. Cheers.
And you. Cheers, Brian. Bye bye. Well, James. There's a bit of worry from Brian there about, well, if you only told me what it is I've got to get worried about, I'd get worried about it. They're out of his control, aren't they? Whether it's going to be absorption of 7.5% tariff, whether it's going to be changing his trucking routine, they're out of his control. So what can he mitigate in that respect? What can he do?
So I think his experience does actually reflect a lot of small businesses. So you're right, there's a lot that is out of his control. There's a lot that you can't, you know, be 100% prepared for right now. Tariffs is a good example. But it sounds like they're doing the right thing. So it sounds like they've got staff on board who have all the experience and expertise that they need to deal with things like customs paperwork and so on. So they hopefully will be in a good position because of that. The other thing that's interesting is that as a company, they have experience of, you know, shipping their products outside of the EU as well. And that's reflective of a lot of other small businesses' experience. They do have that knowledge that hopefully will transfer to the, you know, post 1st of January future. But, you know, there are lots of things out of their control. So, you know, tariffs, it sounds like if there's a deal, they'd be in a position to meet the kind of origin thresholds, and they'd qualify for the zero tariff, which is really good. But then when it comes to things like logistics, you know, we don't really know what January is going to look like. We expect some disruption, but how much, we're not sure.
In terms of the origin issue, when you say that they can meet it, I understand origin, but what do you mean by meet it?
So in a theoretical deal between the UK and the EU, we're talking about a zero tariff, zero quota deal, right? But to qualify for that, that zero tariff, you need to prove that your product is of the origin threshold. So it's basically a UK product. And from the sounds of things, from their production process, you know, they're relying on wool that's, you know, made in Scotland.
So what you're talking about is the stuff that goes in it is has to originate, and the action has to originate. That's what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much. You're listening to Preparing for Brexit with me, Digby Jones, here on Times Radio. Next, we're travelling down south. We're leaving the Outer Hebrides and we're heading right the way down to the northern home counties, to Aylesbury. And we're going to meet an entrepreneur who saw a gap in the market, identified it and went for it and filled it. She's Sophie Burkett. She runs her own company called Scream with Envy. And she joins me from her warehouse, which no better place than you can smell it, taste it and understand how you're making money. Sophie, good of you to give me some time. Hello.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for having me.
So you set the company up yourself, 3 years ago? What is it exactly you make? What is it?
Well, we make really, really attractive privacy screens. They're normally used in people's gardens, but they can also be used in the home, restaurants. We do a lot of things connected to COVID now. So we do kind of protective screens for nail salons, restaurants, this type of stuff.
How did all that come about?
It actually ties into Brexit. So I was actually a stay-at-home mum for 3 years, loving my life. Everything was great. There was a lot of kind of turmoil, as you know, kind of during the Brexit announcement and stuff like that. And at that time, my husband lost his job. And it was one of those things where I'd had this idea and I'd love these products and I use them at my house. And I thought, you know what, this is my chance to kind of launch it and see if there's other people out there who might have the same problems that I have. And it seems that there are.
And where do you make them?
Well, we make them actually in three different locations. So it kind of depends on the product range. So we either make them in Aylesbury or we make them in factories in Bulgaria, or we make them in China. So it depends really on exactly the product type. And so some of the questions I had today was kind of linked into that, because at the moment we sell to European clients and really clients all over the world in certain ways, but obviously issues around kind of countries of origin and stuff like that.
Yeah, so forgive my simplicity, because I'm going to get my guru who's sitting alongside me here to do that. James, you've just had your 10-second warning. But my simplicity would be that it is possible there's a scenario where you're having something made in Bulgaria, which is in the European Union, and you bring it in to Aylesbury and you sell it. So you're an importer of something and you've got to get through a border which changes on the 1st of January. Then you're making something in Aylesbury and you're selling it to, let's pick it, I don't know, Barcelona. There you go. And therefore, exactly, you've got to get it. You've got to get through the border the other way. Now, you've got James, he's the head of international affairs at the FSB. Ask away, Sophie, ask
Amazing.
Away.
I suppose some of my issues are kind of really basic, is around, like, we sell products that might be made in a number of different locations. So a good example is like a fence. We might make the 80% of that fence in our factory in Bulgaria, but then the really attractive, beautiful bits at the top that are cut for a customs client, you know, custom design, we would cut that in Aylesbury. So the end product might actually be coming from three different locations, but for the end client who we're selling to, who might be in the Netherlands, it's effectively one product.
Yeah, so the way it works, so obviously rules of origin is very complicated, but essentially you're looking at, it's the value, so the added value. For instance, you could import part of the finished product from China, but then finish it in the UK or even in Bulgaria. And if that value is over the threshold, will hopefully be in the trade agreement between the UK and the EU, which is normally just over 50% value. It should qualify. But it's very complicated. And the best thing I can recommend, actually, is if you work with an intermediary, so it could be someone like the Chambers of Commerce who do things like certificates of origin or another provider, they're usually the best people who can kind of hold your hand through the process. That would be my advice.
James, when you just said to Sophie, it should work, you mean on that basis with that certificate, she wouldn't be end up after January the 1st paying any more duty? Is that what you mean by it should work?
Well, it depends on obviously the values involved and the product. I mean, if you have a product that is made, you know, in your Bulgarian factory or your UK factory, the way it will work is if your product qualifies under the origin threshold, you should qualify for the zero duty. It gets a bit more complicated when it involves China, but, you know, it will depend on the actual product itself.
Yeah. And Sophie, I guess that if the Bulgarian ambassador is listening to this, and I'm sure he is, I'm sure they make the nice little bits in Bulgaria as well as just the ordinary bits. Yes. Sophie, when you knew Brexit was coming down the pipe, did you feel alone and bereft, or did you think I can get lots of help? I mean, I'm just interested in...
You know what? Like, to be totally frank with you, and I'm literally the last person to blow my own horn, but I started a business 3 years ago with 3 kids under 4 at home and no childcare. So I'm literally not the type of person to kind of be like, oh dear, I'm bereft, what am I going to do? So I just cracked on, really. So we kind of had to make a really clear decision whether we would integrate further into the EU and try to get more business there, or whether we try to slow down really advertising and finding clients in the EU and focus more on the UK. We, you know, had kind of some discussions and stuff like that, and we decided to be bold. So basically, we're going to open up a distribution centre and a warehouse in the Netherlands, ideally before the end of the year. And so in a way, there's been no assistance whatsoever, but it's forced us to be bold, and it's forced us to be closer to our European clients. So in a way, I'm actually really excited about the future. We'll learn about all this stuff as we go, but we are where we are.
Yeah, no, I get that. And the distribution centre will take its product before distribution around Europe from Aylesbury or direct from Bulgaria or China?
No, so we will take it the first round. We'll probably just put on tracks and send from Aylesbury before that cutoff of Jan 1st, when it's going to be more simple. Probably in, you know, peak period, we're going to have to look at how, you know, what's the most optimum way of filling that warehouse and stuff like that. We'll probably have some cutting machines in Venlo, just so that we can provide that high-end service that we do in the UK.
And so you woke up. You woke up one morning and decided to be bold and decided to go for it. Why Holland? And also, how did you find the place? I mean, how did you go? Did you go off and go and get some estate agents' particulars, or what did you do?
I got in my car after I worked for like 9 hours, and I drove all the way to Venlo to go and look at it, and then I got back in my car and drove all the way back.
And why Venlo?
It's just such a good logistics location. I mean, when you arrive there, it's uncanny. So for the first hour when you're kind of approaching it, you don't actually see other cars. You basically only see trucks, containers and warehouses. So you get this sense that you're entering like a major logistics hotspot for Europe. So for us, that's exciting. It's incredible.
And you drove around Venlo till you found an empty warehouse, did you?
No, I actually just found the warehouse from the UK.
Online. You went online and
literally online. And then I thought, you know what? You need to go and see it, because there might be some crazy neighbor next door. You never actually know a warehouse until you're like right in front of it. But no, it's a great, great location.
So there's quite a bit of self help in this.
Yeah, definitely.
And Sophie, I've still got my guru here. So what else would you like to ask him? Because he's not actually cheap today. He's free.
I'm excited. All right. So the main one I wanted to ask is that basically through issues around like clearing customs and stuff like that within the EU, my basic understanding is that I'm better to set up an EU subsidiary rather than an EU branch office. I've looked at the kind of information around that, and it seems like it's probably more advantageous to create an EU subsidiary versus an EU branch office for legals of like legal separation and stuff like that. That's the path that we'll probably take. But it's kind of interesting to hear from you if that would be correct or what your thoughts would be.
Yeah, so there are lots of benefits to having a subsidiary. So for things like VAT, it can make it a lot simpler if you have an EU subsidiary. And it's also the case that if you are selling any products that require to have an authorised representative in the EU, then a subsidiary can fulfil that role. So there are all sorts of benefits to it. I think a bit of advice I'd say if you're looking at setting up a subsidiary is to perhaps make contact with, in this case, the Netherlands Enterprise Agency, because they exist to help companies like yourself set up.
Yeah, I mean, the subsidiary is basically set up already. We had no time to waste, but I was more to hear, do you think this is the right thing to do?
So branch office versus subsidiary, it kind of comes down to your company. And from the sounds of things, for your company, from what you're saying, a subsidiary sounds quite sensible. You know, I've also spoken to other FSB members, for instance, in services, for whom a subsidiary makes sense. It is a real option, definitely.
Okay, cool. I suppose our concern was we heard all these fear stories that was like, oh, from January the 1st, you won't be able to sell and dispatch to European clients from the UK without having this physical presence there. And in a way, this has pushed us to open up an operation there. We probably should have done it a while ago because it makes it so much better for us to be closer to our clients there. It's really interesting to hear.
That's great. And Sophie, I wish you all, not only just all the best, but the best that you deserve. And you know, Napoleon called us a nation of shopkeepers. He didn't mean retail. He meant small businesses. He did. He meant small businesses and a force to be reckoned with. And there you go, off conquering Europe. I'm really proud of you. And thank you for giving me from your warehouse today. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
You're listening to Preparing for Brexit with Digby Jones here on Times Radio. We're now going back up north. We're staying in England, but in the very, very tip of England, on the northeast, north of Newcastle. And we're going to Cramlington. And this is a company that makes furniture, but not, shall we say, the low end of the market. It's a company called George Smith. And it's the sort of stuff which, if you've ever been in a nightclub or in a posh hotel in reception and you've looked at those amazing chairs and you've thought to yourself, oh, I'd just love to go and lose myself in one of those. Well, some of it will have come from the northeast of England. And to tell us a little bit about George Smith, here is Jim Athey. Jim, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Tell me a bit about yourself. Was I right? You're the operations manager there, so you know all about where it's going and how's it doing. Was I right in saying that it reaches the nightclubs and hotels of around the world?
Absolutely. We're supplying 4,000 pieces of upholstered furniture into high-end residential and hospitality projects every year. So we're selling globally. We have showrooms in London, New York, Chicago, also in Los Angeles, and we have a network of distributors throughout the US and EU. So it's a global business, but it's all centered in Northumberland, where we employ 100 craftsmen and women in a factory here in the Northeast.
Oh, well done. Have you been focusing at all on the end of transition on the 1st of January next year?
Absolutely. You know, as I said, we're a global operation, so we're well hooked in to the EU and around the world, and 33% of what we produce is exported. Half of that goes to the EU. Brexit has been a big thing on our agenda.
Yeah. And what special things have you been doing? If I wanted to pick out and say, look, that's what they were doing, and wasn't that a good thing? What do you look at and think, yeah, I got myself ready in that respect?
So for us, there's two sides of Brexit. There's the sales side. Fortunately, we're experienced global exporters, so we're familiar with the export documentation. We have good relationships with freight forwarders. We operate, as I said, through distributors. So this is an advantage to us because we're in a good place and we know who we're talking to. So we've organised economic operator numbers and we have plans in place with them around duty and customs documentation. The flip side of it is on bringing materials in. So we use the finest materials you can find. And whilst much of that comes from some excellent businesses here in the UK, the supply chains extend into the EU and around the world. So to protect our customers, we have put in place additional stock, and we have the means to do this. But I do feel for some businesses who might not have the cash or the storage space to do that.
And what one thing in your obvious, honest look at it all, which you clearly are a plain speaker, so what one thing do you wish you'd done a bit more of, or do you wish had been done better in the last few months in connection with Brexit?
We're a highly bespoke manufacturer. You know, our clients can tailor the size, the finish, the configuration of their furniture, or even commission something which is entirely unique. But one of the most common customizations is the fabric, and this is my small area of concern. On our search for the best of the best, it means we source fabrics from around the world, and much of that comes from France, Belgium, Italy, and the Netherlands. Unfortunately, whilst we work with some great suppliers, for example, we have this great guy in Europe who sources some incredible leathers. The hides come in from Germany, they're tanned in Italy, and then they're shipped over to us. But it's this last step, getting it to us, which is the concern. You know, we appreciate that we've got to prioritise medical supplies, and we're hearing that there's some schemes are in place for components going into the car manufacturing industries and the like. But many goods, like fabric, that go into labour-intensive businesses such as ours could potentially be delayed. You know, we've got 17 million jobs in small and medium enterprises, and many of those could be at risk if these supply chains aren't kept moving. We're hearing that ports are going to be a potential bottleneck, and with all of these other items being prioritised, we could well be at the back of that queue.
Yeah, and by the back of the queue, you mean genuinely the truck coming in last onto the cross channel, whatever it may be.
Exactly, and this is, you know, you mentioned the channel, and straight away that's the focus. The entire country seems to be talking about Dover and the South Coast, but meanwhile, we have some great ports in the northeast here. You know, we've got Tees Port, Port of Tyne, and very locally to us, we've got Wye. These are facilities that could be key to ensuring goods keep moving.
And are you planning to use those ports in the northeast?
We will if we get the opportunity to do so. But things need to be put in place to support them ports to be used.
Yeah, and that is both the businesses saying we want to, and it's government providing the incentive, be it a free port or infrastructure improvement or whatever it may be.
Exactly.
Only a few weeks now to the end of transition. Is there anything you've left to be done yet? Have you got a stone unturned? I've heard what you've been doing, but is there anything that you've got, you know, you need to do in the next few weeks?
No, you know, we're in a very strong position. We've got stocks in place to support us. We've known about this for a long time. You know, we did this preparation last year. It's almost like a comfortable pair of shoes now. You know, we've got a plan. We've run it. We had a nice dry run, and now we're doing it again. And we're in a good place.
Does that mean that you've got 43 warehouses full of horsehair?
We've got more than you would imagine, and our horsehair and lots of the things that go into furniture tend to be quite bulky. So storage is a challenge.
And it's tying up your cash in stockpiling, but it'll be worth its while. Really will be worthwhile doing it if it means that you keep your customers happy, won't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Our customers, you know, as you would expect, They are, you know, fairly unforgiving when it comes to delays or any issues. So we have to be positioning ourselves to protect them.
Yeah. Well, Jim, thank you very much indeed. Thank you for your time. I wish you well. It's an area of Britain I've been up many times and visited loads of businesses. I did one of my troubleshooter programs from Bishop's Auckland. So it's an area I know well. And I'm just thrilled to bits that you're a global excellent business. And I wish you well on January the 1st, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Well, still with me here on Preparing for Brexit with Digby Jones is James Sibley, Head of International Affairs at the FSB. You've now listened to three different businesses, James, in three different parts of Britain, three different sectors. Any threads that you can say are similar or anything that fills you with alarm?
I think the thing I'd say first off is that you've got three businesses who, you know, they're clearly doing the right thing, which is they're, you know, they're thinking about the changes ahead and they're making adjustments when they can. I mean, even the last business, you know, you can't really control, you know, the disruption potentially at European ports shipping goods to the UK. But it sounds like he's doing everything right. He's, you know, he's thinking about alternative ports to Dover. You know, he's working with his suppliers. These are all really good things to be doing. So I've been really impressed listening to each of the business owners talk about their experience.
And have you got anything that you would say that has been alarmingly missing in any of them, or you think they're going to be okay?
Well, the thing that comes through is the thing that comes through in each of my conversations with businesses on this topic, which is, you know, the uncertainty element. And that's the thing that is hard to plan for. So, you know, are there going to be tariffs? And if so, what do we need to do? You know, what's the border situation actually going to be like come January and beyond? And that's less alarming. It's kind of a, you know, it's a message I've heard repeatedly now. And unfortunately, the answer is you can do what you can to prepare, and then the rest, it will depend on what comes down the line.
And one thing, James, that's come through for me is that so many of these people get up and go. You know, they see the obstacle, they get up and go and deal with it. And whether it's the time capacity or the money capacity, they seem to be on path for getting on with it and getting around the obstacles. Is that normal in your 200,000 members? I mean, is that a characteristic of a small business, or have we just lighted on unusual businesses?
So I think a common characteristic of small businesses is that, you know, they are nimble, and fundamentally they are optimists. You know, you don't go into business if you're not optimistic about your chances. So in that sense, they are pretty representative. I think the one thing, the kind of businesses I encounter who, you know, perhaps they're uncertain or they're not quite finished their preparations, is perhaps exporting is less of a feature of their business. It's still a feature, but in terms of volume, perhaps it's a bit lower. And for them, it's you know, they're thinking about what do they need to do, what's worth my time. And obviously, the other thing that's behind backgrounding all of this is COVID, that we've not touched on so much. You know, COVID's had a tremendous impact on many firms, both in terms of cash flow and cash reserves. And that's made it really tricky. If you've got businesses that are trying to survive till the end of the year, making preparations for the end of transition on top of that is quite tricky.
Yeah. Interestingly, I was impressed by the fact that their spirit, their wish to go and do it and get over it and make the most of it, transcended everything. It transcended the location of the business. It transcended transcended what they did, how they did it. It was very much a broad characteristic. And as you just said, I think, you know, they're nimble, they're light on their feet, they can do it. But on the other hand, they don't have capacity of people or money and resources in the same way as big businesses, do they?
Exactly. But these are things that can be overcome by things like working with your suppliers, working with your logistics partner. And by the sounds of things, the three companies that you've spoken to are doing exactly that. So even if you are limited in resource, there are still things you can do. And it's great to see that they're doing it.
And also, your 200,000 members, perhaps some of them are listening and thinking, yeah, we can do it too. So that'll be good. James, just to say thank you very much indeed. Thank you for your time. And here's to a successful end of transition. Thanks very much.
Pleasure. Bye-bye. Thank you.
You're listening to Preparing for Brexit with Digby Jones here on Times Radio. Now, what happens if You're not even someone who employs 45 people, which would be a small business. You're not even someone who employs 20 people. You're not even somebody who employs 15. You actually employ just a few, just four or five, say, what we would call a micro business. To help me understand where the issues are so different, I want to introduce to you Emma Jones, no relation, by the way. She's from an organisation that she runs called Enterprise Nation. Emma, hello.
Hello there, Digby.
Just tell me about you, the sort of member of your organisation, the sort of business. What would it be?
Well, they are the small businesses to which you were just referring, even though I have to say one comment I always make about our members is they may be small, but they're very mighty. So it is micro entrepreneurs, 0 to 10 employees, in terms of the size of their business. And in terms of what they do, they're selling everything from food and drink to fashion, but also to business services. Many start and grow from home. They are exporting and they try and be as efficient as possible in their operations.
And just so I can get a handle on the characteristic of what you do, are you more banging the drum on their behalf, what I would call a trade association, lobbying and fighting? Or are you an advisory service where you actually give them advice and point them in the direction? Or are you both?
We do both. So, yes, businesses come to us with lots of questions on their mind. And of course, we've been very busy in the past 7 months. So businesses have wanted to know how to build websites, how to manage cash flow, how to keep on exporting. Because we're in contact with so many small businesses, we understand what's on their mind. We understand their trade challenges, and therefore we represent those views to government and to others in society at large.
Yeah. And there's no prize for understanding what's been foremost on their mind. I should think it's survival through the past 7 months of COVID. So do you see the next few weeks as bringing Brexit up to number one on the attention graph or not? Are they just going to deal with it on January the 2nd?
Yeah, there is an element of businesses will deal with it at the time. This happened with GDPR. We saw this happen when GDPR came into effect. Many businesses dealt with it on the day itself. But the one thing, Digby, which has been fascinating for us to see over these past few months, is business owners have really put things in perspective. And they feel incredibly resilient at the moment. They have a strength of mind, which essentially is taking the approach that if I can deal with COVID, my business can deal with anything. And therefore, they're possibly looking upon 1st of January in a slightly more, I'm not going to say positive way, but I'm going to say in a way where they feel stronger to be able to take anything on. So if there are new tariffs, if there's new customs documentation, if they need to sort out how their data flows in and out of Europe, then they feel, right, I've just been through a harsh 7 months, I can deal with it when it comes.
Emma, we're going to bring into our conversation a micro business. It's owned by a lady called Jackie Ma in the trendy part of East London, and it makes and sells the panniers for cycles. And of course, bicycles have become the mode of transport, the preferred one, and especially so in cities, and especially so since the pandemic got hold. Jackie, hello.
Hi there, Digby.
Hi, thanks for joining me. You set up your own company. When did you do that?
I set it up in 2012.
Oh, yeah. And it's an office above a garage, isn't it?
Yeah, it started off on top of a bike shop where I lived. The bicycle pannier market was just quite sort of boring and drab, and the bags that I design are sort of colourful and aimed at women and families and things like that.
And so how did you go about finding your pannier to sell to people?
Well, my background is in design, so I design the bags and get them made in China and then sell them wholesale and direct to the customer.
And do any of your customers, are they in the European Union?
Yeah, about 10% of my customers are through the EU, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so you get things in from China, you've designed them, the added value bit is with you, and then you're selling them out of Britain and into the European Union, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Tell me, what's your business called, Jackie?
It's called good ordering in one word. So it's like when you go out to a restaurant and you order well. So you're happy with your ordering.
And how did you... Why? Why?
My background is Chinese, and you know, we always went out for big meals where everyone shares. So my mum would always order for everyone. So the whole idea is that the brand is all about family and sharing, and you know, getting together. And
well, you've got Emma Jones with me, and she is quite experienced in getting micro businesses ready for how the board is going to change on the 1st of January. Is there anything you'd like to ask her?
Yeah, I mean, I have a huge amount of questions, Emma. And like you said, I'm probably one of those businesses who will, you know, kind of deal with all of the transition on the 2nd of January. And I've been really focused on survival as well. But I guess things like questions to do with boring things like VAT and just import tax and things like that into Europe are things that I don't know.
Yeah, well, Jackie, it's lovely to hear you. That is an interesting one, actually. So from the 1st of January, for VAT purposes, the UK becomes what's called a third country. And therefore, that means any sales of products outside of the UK into the EU will be zero rated. So it means you apply no VAT when you're selling it. However, depending on the deals you have with your customers, it may mean you have to become VAT registered in the EU country into which you're selling. Now, I appreciate that for a company such as yours, you could be looking at registering for VAT in 27 EU states, which is probably a little bit too big a burden.
Yeah, I don't think I would go down that path. I mean, just from a, you talked about efficiency before, and I think with small companies like mine, the whole idea is just to keep the amount of paperwork as simple as possible.
I think there will be, this is where entrepreneurial people in other EU states, I think, will rise up, because one other option for small businesses is to appoint what's called a financial representative. So rather than you registering for VAT, you have someone who acts on your behalf. And I do think what we'll see following January's, you know, kind of new deal, new rules, I think we will see new entrepreneurial models in EU states that hopefully will give you that efficiency to keep trading where you don't have to have the friction that comes with it.
Jackie, I understand that you've identified France as a possibly good market for you. Is there anything, Emma, that the from right now, oh, I think France is a good market, what she should be doing next?
If Jackie was to be looking at the French market, of course you want to do market research, just as you would. But I would say also look for local partners. Many businesses are considering maybe setting up a company outfit in the EU, so at least they have a presence. But I think local partnerships will become even more important, because British businesses will be reliant on local partners on the ground.
This is a question to both of you, actually, because I'm interested with a micro business as to the problem with this. HMRC sent this admonishing letter, I would guess would be a good way of putting it, saying to hundreds of thousands of businesses, come on, get yourself sorted. You need to do this. Are you ready? I think it only came from the tax man, because they've got more details of how to reach all the businesses than anybody else, I guess. I don't think there's any connotation of tax or VAT or duty in it. But it's more about get yourself ready. Did you have one of those letters, Jackie?
Yeah, I have a pile of letters about Brexit that I just sort of have filed away with all the other letters.
Oh, that's really constructive, isn't it? that's not the plan. That's not what you're meant to do. You're meant to open it, read it, inwardly digest it, and deal with it. So what are you going to do? You're
going to deal with of them and send them to my accountant. But
you're going to deal with it on January the 2nd, are you?
Yeah, I mean, I have partners that are trusted and they've done their homework. So my shipping company and my accountant and, you know, lawyers, things like that. So I'm confident that it will be okay, but there's not really that much that I can personally do.
Yeah. And in fact, that's a lesson, isn't it? Get yourself well partnered, get yourself well advised, get people you can depend on. Yeah, I get that. And Emma, do you think Jackie's one of millions like that, or do you think she's unusual?
No, I think Jackie is one of millions, and we weren't hugely happy with the tone of that campaign, Digby. It, as you say, it was admonishing small businesses, telling them they're running out of time, which I thought was a little bit rich when we've been asking government for the past 3 years to bring out a support programme to help businesses get ready for Brexit. So, yes, yeah. Businesses have had lots on their mind this year, and I didn't think that was quite the right approach to take.
At the start of this programme, you know, I was asking Brian Wilson up in Harris Tweed, up in the Hebrides, is he ready? And he, my words, not his, but he basically said, if you tell me what I've got to get ready for, I'll go and get ready. And I thought, yeah, good point, very good point. While we've got Emma here, Jackie, is there anything else you'd like to quiz her on?
I guess I just wonder about sort of individual consumers and also retailers, how you think that might change after the 1st of January, as in what's the feel of how they'll look at UK companies? You know, have we kind of left their gang and they're not going to support us, or do you think that they'll carry on buying from UK companies like mine?
Yeah, I think this is very interesting. And a couple of reflections on this. We took a food and drink trade trip to Paris once the UK decided to leave the EU. And we did say, will you stop buying from us? And actually the response from the French market is, if you have products or services that we want, we'll keep on buying. So we'll sort of put that political view to one side because customers still want what they want. However, we have since heard stories of retailers in Europe cancelling orders with UK companies. However, on the upside, we've heard of American retailers swooping straight in and saying, well, actually, we'll place some orders because the politics of it don't matter so much to us. So I think, Jackie, and you are brilliant at doing this, business owners will look and say, if the opportunity is no longer in that market, I will turn to where the opportunity is. And of course, we do have a trade secretary in the form of Liz Truss, who is tromping around the world at the moment, doing deals with Japan, with Korea, talking to New Zealand. And of course, we'll wait to see what happens with the US. So I would say, if you're getting any sense in your market that European retailers are not too keen to buy from British suppliers, I would say rapidly turn your attention to other markets, because anything that's made or designed in Britain still has good legacy.
When I was trade minister and I got around, what was it, some 63 countries in a couple of years, and I just learned so much, but I did come to understand how valued the Union flag on a product is. It sells. And, it, you know, we have our problems in the world, arrogance and slow and all the rest of it. And we wash our dirty linen in public so much compared with other countries. But they do like buying our stuff. There's no doubt about it. And I think, Emma, that's such good advice. You know, if you get a country that's in Europe saying, yeah, boo, you know, you're leaving us, don't want you, there will be many countries in the world that will say, yep, come on, we'll have them. We like you. And that's absolutely right. Jackie, I'd like to thank you. Thank you for your time. Good luck. Good luck with the panniers. And I wish good ordering all the success in the world. Take care. Bye-bye. Emma, I wanted to just ask you on behalf of everyone listening to this, but also, I guess, on behalf of the Jackies of this world and the Sophies and whatever, if they're sitting there thinking, I've only got a few weeks to go, do you know, I haven't done enough, and I know when I look in the mirror, I haven't done enough. Where can they go? What can they do? I mean, Jackie seemed quite happy on give it to my accountant, give it to my lawyer, give it to my partners. And by the way, that must be good advice. But for a lot of micro businesses, they don't have those sorts of people. So what can they do with just a few weeks to go? Where can they go to get this information?
Yeah, well, the government has got a very good website, gov.uk/transition, where businesses can go as of today, and you answer some questions and you can get access to a checklist of things you need to do. But Digby, as you say, for businesses that want more of a support network, so they want access to advisors, indeed they want to talk to other businesses to say, what are you doing? Then of course, networks such as Enterprise Nation, local growth hubs, so economic development agencies in your own area, these are the places where you'll find the support you need, practical advice, but also more psychological support to help you get through it. 1st of January, keep trading and beyond.
I'd add one to that. I've always been a fan of the supply chain. And I always think that the person you're buying off and the person you're selling to, if you're selling not just on price, but the person you're selling to a value-added product and the person you're buying off, they have a vested interest in you doing okay. And there's nothing wrong with a quick chat to one of the people you supply or one of the people who supply you and just say, I need a bit of help here, or what have you done? Can I learn from you? There's no harm in that and being in it together. Don't feel you're on your own. I think, Emma, you're living proof that you've got together a load of micro businesses that have proved they're not on their own.
Absolutely, and it is so important. And Digby, quite often for businesses, and this has certainly been the case this year, they've understood practically what they need to do, but it has been that need for confidence and assurance from others that has kept them going. So I think that is critically important.
Yeah, I'm going to say my goodbye to you, but I just want to say thank you personally for one of the things you said more than any other, which was this fact that your membership and indeed every business, I guess, but every small business has come through the searing heat of a furnace of challenge that they've never, ever dreamt they'd have to face in the last 7 months. And if they are still standing and they're standing with a viable business, they will feel they can actually take on the world and win.
Literally take on the world. As I said, Digby, they may be small, but they are very, very mighty.
Yeah. And on that, I'll say thank you to you. Emma Jones, Enterprise Nation. Good to talk to you. Well, that brings me to the end of a look at small businesses. Thank you very much for listening. There are other programmes in this series. The last one, last week, we talked about manufacturing. You can still find that, by the way, on the Times Radio website if you'd like to have a listen. And I hope you will, because there's a continuity and a getting ready for this massive change on the 1st of January. And I'll be back next time with the next episode. I hope some good conversation. I hope some good counsel and some good advice. And so, for now, from Times Radio, from Preparing for Brexit with me, Digby Jones. Bye-bye.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com